Well, we've been talking about misunderstandings. And that book that the one guy, Mark Sillyander, wrote, I thought was aptly named, but not for the reason he thought. The book he wrote was called The Deadly Misunderstanding. I think he actually had the deadly misunderstanding. And I think that commonly we do too. We don't understand. It's a little harder in a way if you live in Billings or you live out here in Montana, because we just don't have a whole lot of Muslims in our population. And in a way, that's for me, that's too bad, because Muslims, in my experience, are very easy to get to know. They're very easy to make friends with. You have a built-in advantage because many, many Muslims want to proselytize you. So if you wanted to talk about God, you're not going to find an easier person to come alongside of than Muslims, generally speaking. When we lived in London, I always found it a whole lot harder to talk to Brits about Jesus than I did to talk about Muslims about Jesus. And in my opinion, we're kind of more like Brits than we are like the Muslims. Well, let's do a little fact check. We have a happy Christian who is standing next to and getting his little photograph taken with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who has historically, since the 1920s, been one of the most outspoken critics of Christianity and Judaism. Let's just go run through some facts. You know, in the last hour, we looked at this attempt of Muslims to reach out in a dialogue. We talked about what many of the evangelical responses were to that. We talked about why those were less than satisfactory. And then I think the last thing we did before the break was we unpacked what the common word was actually saying, which was not what we were thinking. And that sort of underscores the point I've been trying to make, that when we hear what they say, we're not actually hearing what they mean. First thing to know about Islam, and I believe this is the first thing, this comes before the Quran or anything else, Islam is all about imitating Muhammad. Before the Quran was ever completed, believers were being called to follow Muhammad, the person. I don't know of any Muslims, actually, that rely on the Quran as their rule of life. I don't actually know any personally. But I know every Muslim I know looks to Muhammad as a model for their life. Now, if you look at 1,000 different Muslims, they may have a variety of responses about who Muhammad was. But they're all going to look to Muhammad. Muhammad cannot be insulted. Muhammad cannot be represented pictorially. You remember the cartoons, the Danish cartoons? That's what happens when you insult a prophet. So if you really want to get to the heart of Islam, you really need to get to the heart of Muhammad. You can read the Quran in any different version, translation, or whatever that you want. You will not get to the heart of Islam. You'll only get to the heart once you understand who Muhammad was, what he did, how he lived, and how he gathered a people around himself. Second fact check, there is no such thing as a religion of Islam separated from the territorial expansion of Islam. Historically speaking, they happen together. Let me tell it a different way. Islam was codified. Islam came together as a religion at the same time as Muhammad was creating an army, creating a way of governing people, and creating even an economy in Medina. All of those things took place at the same time. So any question of saying that Islam is not a religion of violence or war, you can't honestly say it isn't in a sense. You can say not all Muslims want to go to war. That's a fair statement. But you can't say Islam is not about that. It always has been. There's never been a period of Islamic history where the two weren't woven together in some way. So there was no Islam. Islam would never have been created without territorial expansion. Muhammad had to win Medina. Muhammad had to win Mecca. Muhammad had to fight a war after that inside Arabia to defeat other movements he considered heretical that were rejecting his authority. So he fought all those wars, and then Islam expanded out beyond its borders. At the very same time his theology was being created, he was expanding militarily. It all happened together. Another fact that needs to be borne in mind, it's very, very important. It's kind of a subtle point. I'm going to, in my sledgehammer way, I'll try and make it easy to get. Islamic empires were created by outright force, conquest, slow encroachment, and coercion. It's important that you understand all of them. If Muhammad was playing golf, he had a bag with a lot of clubs in it. He's knocking the ball forward towards the hole. But he has many means with which to do that. Does that make sense? Outright force in the history of the conquests of Islam. After the death of Muhammad, his successors burst out beyond the borders of Arabia and headed north up into Syria, and places like that. The people that they encountered were fundamentally two groups. The Byzantines, who were Eastern Orthodox Christians in religion, and the Persians, who were mostly Zoroastrians at the time. Before the conquests, the Zoroastrians from Persia and the Byzantines were fighting together in a costly and deadly war. And that war lasted long enough that it wore both down. Large areas north of Saudi Arabia were depopulated. The chroniclers would talk about people traveling for days without seeing anyone. Abandoned villages, things like that. The two powers, these two kingdoms, had fought a war of attrition against each other. At the end of the war, the Christians won. But they were so weakened by their victory that neither they nor the Persians were able to withstand the armies that the Arabs from Arabia sent against them. Now, what all that means is that the conquests took place really quickly. Within a couple of generations, they had spanned all across North Africa, they had gone all across the Near East, and into Central Asia. Happened quickly. What didn't happen that quickly was people convert. For a long time, the Muslims were a tiny minority. But they were the people running the show. Underneath them were majority Christian populations. What the Muslims did as rulers was they implemented a lot of different measures to put pressure on Christians. they started a poll tax called the jizya, which was a punitive tax. If you were a Christian, you could be a Christian, but you had to give up all this money. There were certain kinds of employment that you couldn't have. It's a little bit like in the book of Revelation when they're talking about the seven churches, the kinds of persecution that the Christians are suffering in the churches are not all the same. Some it was the sword. Sometimes it was financial ruin. In the lands conquered by the Muslims, you have this situation where you've got Christians living as a majority, but they're being treated as less than citizens, a lot less. The legal system worked prejudicially against the Christians. You could easily be sued by Muslims and lose everything that you have. When the Ottomans became the center of power of an Islamic imperial power in the 14th century to start with, the stormtroopers, the guys that did the deadliest fighting were called Janissaries. Janissaries were kidnapped Christian boys that were raised as fanatical Muslim warriors. So hanging over your head if you were a Christian in these countries was a series of coercive measures that was over time intended to force you into becoming a Muslim. The only country that I know of where Christians fought back hard, by the way, this is not a happy story for the Christians either. As you see there, the Islamic Empire succeeded because clergy and politicians did not fight back. Let that be a lesson to you. They didn't fight back. They did not resist. They tried to cut deals. They tried to get the best they could out of it because they did well for two reasons. One, they wanted to minimize suffering, but the other reason was that the Muslims that took over these countries were not good administrators, and they would use Christians to administer rule for them. So in a sense, they were buying people. The only exception was Egypt, where the Copts resisted them greatly for a long, long time. The back of Coptic Christians was broken not until the 14th century, really, in series of pogroms, where Muslims would come and burn people alive, burn down churches by the hundreds, and they would use intimidation like that to bring about conversion. I've spent a lot of time on this because one of the stories that we hear, especially by the nice people that wanted to affirm the common word, is that Islam is a religion of peace and Islam grew primarily through persuasion. Well, yeah, kind of, but it's a persuasion the hard way. Christians also failed because they thought they could rely on dialogue and concessions. Guess what? And I will prove it to you. We are doing exactly that. We make concessions in order to make people reasonable. Our hope is that they're reasonable, we're reasonable. Muslims are reasonable, but they're reasonable in their way. They have a goal. They have an objective that's built into who they are. And I don't mean a lady with a grocery cart. I mean inside the religion of Islam, there is a forward motion. Another thing that we're told is we're supposed to feel guilty. Remember Joseph Cumming saying you've got to apologize for the Crusades? Well, how come? They started it. Muslims had been invading Christian land for 450 years before the Crusaders even showed up. Now, I'm not an advocate of violence. I'm just saying, let's be fair about this. Another myth that's told is that the Muslims that took control of the Holy Land And in the 11th century, those were Seljuk Turks that took it away from the Arabs. These Turks were also Muslims. And they were even less tolerant than the Arabic people had been. So they would start kidnapping and selling into slavery pilgrims that were headed to Jerusalem and stuff like that. So in one sense, the Crusades is an act of self-defense. The story that I heard when I was in high school, that it was really a bunch of money-grubbing, money-hungry guys from France and Germany and England wanted to make their fortunes in the Middle East is false. More than 90% of the Crusaders were eldest sons that actually gave up everything they had to go into the Middle East. But you didn't all know that. So in my mind, Crusades were a justified act of self-defense. Now that's important to me. Not because I want to vindicate the past. And this is this could be a controversial statement. I think in Muslim lands, Christians do have a right to self-defense. Now they have to decide the best way to do that and what's possible. And it may be better that they flee. What they can't afford to do is compromise. What happened in the early Islamic invasions was they did just that. Christians compromised everywhere. And because they compromised, it gutted their own religious faith and they lost. Reason that you all need to know who Muslim converts are is because Muslim converts know the real deal. They're actually paying that price now. And they're growing. If you want to know how to deal with Islam, talk to them. Well, how did we get it so wrong? Forget the church. Follow Jesus. You see the headline there in the Newsweek? There's a lot of stuff here. We don't have much time to talk about it, so I'll try and cover it as briefly as I can. It's common for us these days to call the philosophy of life that people have postmodernism. Right? Everybody heard that one? You know, it started out as a literary term, I believe. And French guys like using it that way. There's a philosopher named Zygmunt Bauman who said that in his mind, most of the time, what we mean is not postmodern. It's liquid modern. Liquids change their shape much faster than solids. Liquid modernism is a kind of modernism that celebrates change, speed. It discounts permanence. It does not like boundaries or laws or barriers. Those are usually impediments to what it values most, which is seen as progress. Does that make sense? My assertion is that at least since the 1960s, American Westerners, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, celebrate a liquid modernism. We like new things. We like things that change. It's why we have to have a new iPhone every year. Right? Why every product you have has a minor improvement that you must buy. It's tied up in our being consumers. I believe that liquid modernism, though, also has a deep effect on the church, particularly for evangelicals like us. Evangelicals that have lived after World War II primarily have less association now with churches. And the movers and shakers of the evangelical world are often less associated with churches than they are with parachurch organizations or other things. We go to church for the most part. But if you want to get the job done, like if you want to, you know, if you really want to disciple people, like I came to Christ through the Navigators in the early 1970s. Why? They were on the campus. They were getting the job done. It was outside the church. I think over time, over the last 50 years, evangelical Christians have devalued the church. And the PhD is in theology, so it's even more obscure than history. The reason I mention it is because one field of theology this is relevant to is ecclesiology, the theology of the church. There have been very few serious books written on ecclesiology by evangelicals for a very long time. Why? That's because you don't value it that much. Another feature, another factor involved in this is the emergent church, which is almost an expression to me of liquid modernism. Change. It also embraces a collegial attitude towards other religions. Some of the more radical guys in the emergent church movement, people like a guy named Samir Simanovich, who has a big church in Manhattan, believes that his goal in life is actually to see the end of Christianity. And he says it that way. He wants to see Jesus, however, embedded in every other faith system and in every person. So he wants to say yes to Jesus, but say no to the church and no to Christianity. Now, he's sort of on the far left fringe of the emergent church movement. But I believe that there are very close ties to emergent church movement, what we're seeing in terms of reaching Muslims in the world. The Martians have landed. That's my joke. Does anybody get it? Who's Martian? Who was Marcion? Ah, you didn't get it. Okay, you know where the Martians have landed, right? The Martians. Marcion was an early was a person in the early part of Christianity who was a Gnostic. He did not follow the authority of the visible church. He stood outside of it. And Marcion looked at the New Testament and said that there are only parts of this that are authentic. The other parts can be discarded. How did he know that? He knew that because he had kenosis. He had a secret special knowledge that others don't have. The Gnostics were the kind of the forerunners of privatized religion. You can have Jesus your way. You don't actually need the body. It's just you and what you believe. Another factor for getting it wrong is oneism. It's this kind of creeping belief that all religions essentially want the same things and essentially come from the same place. They're all kind of incomplete. Either they're all partly good and they need Jesus to make them better, or they're all screwed up and they need Jesus to fix them. But in a sense, they're all similar in that way. So, church becomes a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. The other thing that I think is important, especially for this group, embracing, not contesting, our minority status. Let me tell you what I mean. Christians are increasingly becoming a minority. Now, I lived in Europe for 10 straight years. We were already a very small minority there. I had a friend of mine who was a Muslim convert from Turkey who came to England once and gave a lecture along with me. And he basically started chastising the Englishman that he was speaking to. And the guts of his talk were, all of you are obsessed with getting PhDs, writing papers, but you don't witness to anybody. He said, you know why you don't witness to people? It was an interesting answer that he gave himself, and I think he nailed it pretty well. It wasn't because the English don't care. It wasn't because the English don't love people. It was because these English Christians at one time had been the most honored people in their culture. They had been respected. If I said I was an evangelical Christian and I said I was a scientist, nobody would look twice. They would say, well, of course. All the scientists are Christians. What makes you so special? But you lost that position. You lost that respect. And you keep trying to get it back before you witness to someone. You want to witness from a high position, not a low one. That was the opinion of this Muslim convert. I think he's quite right about it. When we do that, in a sense, we embrace our minority status. Yeah, okay, we get our degrees and maybe we write some books. Or like me, I make a movie. Maybe somebody watches it. But when things are happening that fundamentally violate our faith, what do we do? What do we do? The value of working in the Muslim world like I do is you find that there are a lot of places out in the world where you actually have to choose. There aren't any fences left. You can't just sit on them because they're not there. You have to do something. You're going to have to go one way or the other. And people do. So how did we get it so wrong? I think we started losing the cultural wars in our country, and we weren't exactly okay with it, but we learned how to live with it. I think the lesson maybe we learned from this issue of the Islamic conquest is maybe that's not the best idea. And lastly, we're losing our tradition, the Christian tradition. I can't tell you how priceless that gift is to us, because that's what tells us who we are and where we're from. And it tells us that we were a minority religion with the most powerful empire in the whole world. And that when those Romans were dropping like flies with the plague in the 3rd century, it was Christians that went to them and ministered in their own homes, because their own families, the Roman families, the pagan families, rejected them. They didn't want to get sick. Christians put their lives on the line for the sake of these pagans. Guess what happened? Some Christians died, some Christians lived, and there became a lot more Christians that used to be pagans. That's our tradition. Removing the blinders. Secular Western thinking, secular Western political philosophy, political science, sociology, anthropology, and all of that is not on the same page as Islam, and it cannot be. Because Islam is a pre-modern system. It existed long before these tools we use to measure it. So we're constantly using terms and ideas to define Muslims, but they don't think of themselves that way ever. Another reason is because Westerners like us, because we are modern people, we break things up into specialties, which is another way of saying we fragment knowledge. It's very rare to find people that have a broad base of knowledge now that can connect things together. So we separate politics and we separate culture and we separate religion and philosophy and other things. But ancient faith systems like Islam and Christianity actually fuse them. They integrate them. If you're a specialist, you can know an awful lot of stuff about one little thing and not know much about much of anything else. It's pretty normal. When I was teaching college at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, we were teaching freshmen and sophomore students, and we adopted something called the Great Books Curriculum from Columbia University. And the curriculum forced us, basically, to put together literature, history, philosophy, and perhaps even geography in one course. The way we'd do it is we'd read great books. So we'd have to read Augustine's Confessions, and we'd have to read Machiavelli, and we'd have to read Plato's Republic, and we'd have to read Voltaire or whatever for a whole year with the students. The students were in a slight panic because they'd never had to read that seriously before. You know, these are American high school students in college for the first time. But the people with the real panic were the college professors. Now, I'm a generalist. I happen to be a generalist, so I'm kind of happy doing this job. But most of the professors were trying to opt out as fast as they could. We're fragmented. We suffer from amnesia. We have so little historical sense that we're constantly stepping into the same hole somebody else already discovered before us. Removing the blinders means, to me, and this is a personal statement, only aggressive Christianity can confront Islam. Now, I don't intend to say that only obnoxious Christianity can confront Islam. Only pejorative Christianity or polemical Christianity. What I'm trying to say is only confident Christianity. You're confident. You're confident that you know the truth. You're confident that you're united with Christ. You're confident that Islam is not a match for Christ. That confidence is what you need. We're not talking about being obnoxious and running over people, but what we are saying is we're not afraid of Islam. To be afraid of Islam, in one sense, is to worship it. Because anything that we fear or worship other than God is an idol. And if we fear Islam more than we trust God, then Islam is our idol. Take that. What that will mean when the rubber hits the road is the last point. And it's the point most Western Christians have long forgotten. But I'm confident that God will help remind us of it again. And that is, we have to accept suffering as part of our witness. That it is impossible to walk away from our witness to Christ. So I like saying we witness to Christ no matter what. That's our heritage. That's how the church grew. And that's what we have to actually revisit and remember. We're about out of time, aren't we? Few minutes? All right, let's see what we can do. What is Islam really? I give you a hint underneath with Joshua 1:3. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I will give to you. Now, that verse was given by God to the Israelites as they were stepping into Canaan. I'm going to suggest it's a hint in understanding what Islam sees itself as. Now, you can get distracted by the images, though, right? The guy on the left, he's not too happy. Or the picture in the middle, people in prayer, you know, at the mosque, you know, or the cute kid. But I think if you really want to know what Islam really is take a look down there at that bottom verse, and we'll come back. You remember this poem by Robert Frost? Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. I believe at a fork of the road in the history of God's revelation to his people. At the fork of the road was Israel. In the book of Acts, the Christian church took one fork. It was a fork that said you didn't have to be Jewish to be a believer. You didn't have to be ethnically Jewish. You didn't have to follow the law. You had to submit to Christ. So we went down that road. We moved away from legalism and pietism as we did. I believe that Islam is best understood as a religion that took the other fork. Now, I know you don't know who that is because that's somebody's imagination in the form of art. That's Saladin, the great Muslim conqueror of Jerusalem. All Muslims comprise something called the Ummah. There are lots of different ways to translate it. Community, it's kind of community. It's more than a religion. It's interesting, I was reading a bunch of stuff on this, that there's quite a lot of misinformation. Some people think that it was based on an Arabic word. It's not. It's based on a Hebrew word. And it's a word that describes a single people that are gathered by God as part of his plan for salvation. Muslims adopt that into their own faith system. Another way of looking at Ummah is people with a common ancestor. Jews, Christians, and Muslims can all say they look at Abraham, for example, as a common ancestor. Jews and Christians say that line runs from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob and then to Jesus, right, through David and all of that. Muslims will say it's Abraham, Ishmael, Isaac, and Jacob. So it's a little different. What's interesting, though, is if you looked at Christians and Jews and Muslims, while they're not identical, they're similar in the sense where they think they have a lineage that's anchored historically in the same place. It all starts in the same place. It all starts with Abraham. Another way of saying Ummah is there are people of the covenant, that God creates man and puts him in the world, men and women, puts them in the world for a purpose, for a reason. He establishes that reason with them, and then he expects obedience. That's the way Muslims look at what a covenant is. So one way of understanding Muslims is that they are a covenantal people that were formed by God. Interesting, isn't it? Because Christians are a covenantal people, and Jews are as well. In the broadest sense, Ummah is a family. Now, that's no fuzzy comment. When I look at the array of Muslims that I've met in my life, they cover everything. From terrorists to imams to friends, housewives, and so on. What puts them all together? I mean, if you got Osama bin Laden on one end of it and Erdogan in the middle, and you've got some guy teaching at King's College in London, what makes them all the same? Well, I've always struggled with that until I realized that Islam in this covenantal sense is a family. Now, families are funny things because you have members of your family you don't like. You have members of the family that are estranged from you. You have members of your family that you feud with. One of the only ways you know it's a family is when someone outside the family threatens you. Then everybody seems to come together. I noticed that more than any other religion I'm aware of, Islam has that habit of circling the wagons, gathering around each other, and not being as critical, for example, as they might be. Behind closed doors, they can beat each other to death. But if you intrude, it's likely they will not. So in that sense, it helped me break through a bit of confusion. If they're all so different, what makes them Muslims? I know Muslim atheists. That's odd, right? They don't even admit to believing in God. Then I remembered something else. I grew up in, forgive me for this, I grew up in New York. And I grew up with mostly Catholics or Jews. There were an awful lot of Jews there that were also atheists. But they were Jews. Muslims can do it too. Starts helping you understand some stuff. If you want the most general term, it's a bounded people. I mean, it's something that makes them different than everyone else. But that picture of family is helpful to me. And that picture of covenant is important because that means, another way of putting it in the Old Testament is they're the chosen people. They see themselves very much in those terms. So, it's a pre-national. What I mean by that is Islam existed before there were nations in the modern sense. When we say nation, we talk about laws and we talk about boundaries and politics and we talk about elected or appointed officials and rulers and stuff like that. Nations in the biblical era and before was a much more general term. But it was a people that had a covenant given to them by God who saw themselves as authentic successors to Jews and Christians. That's different. They're the successors. In my mind, they are more like a successor to Judaism than a successor to Christianity. They have a legalism, a devotion to the law, and a devotion to a kind of pietism that is more like rabbinic Judaism than it's like Christianity. So it's a diverse adopted family, and you could be adopted into Judaism, but you become a Jew. And that gave it a core identity that differentiated it from all other people. It's a pre-modern people that are living in a modern world. And that's where the confusion takes place. It's not just confusing for us to understand them, it's confusing for them. So look at the Arab Spring. You have Muslims on one side of it, wanting to overthrow an autocratic regime. You have other Muslims that are also wanting to overthrow the autocratic regime. Let's say Egypt. One group are Muslims committed to more of a more or less a democratic kind of view of government. Another group of Muslims are the Muslim Brotherhood people. They're all Muslims. They're all militating for change, but they're each dealing with modernism very differently. So it's like laying this covenantal foundation on the ground and then laying a grid over it, which is modernism, and people that live in that modern world have to cope with it. How do I deal with that? And Muslims deal with it differently. Some of them turn into believers in a universal ummah, you know, a universal Muslim state that crosses the whole world. It's global. Other Muslims make no choice like that at all. Maybe most profoundly, it's a missionary organism. And I mean it's an organism. It's almost like a living thing. You don't always know what role you play in it. In some ways, it's impressive. Because an organism like that, everything it does contributes to its witness in the world. Whether that's force or friendship or dialogue, it all serves the same purpose. Finally, there are people that thought that they were not just the chosen people, but the finest expression of humanity that had ever been seen. That's how Islam sees itself. That's what you're taught when you're a Muslim. That the high point of civilization is Islam. The problem you have is that in many places in the world, you're not the high point of civilization. You're pretty much down in the dumps. But if you've been told that you are the high point, you deserve to be the high point. God's called you to be the high point. But somebody else is sitting in your seat. That fosters resentment and a desire to occupy that at some point. You're frustrated. You can turn your frustration against your own rulers or your neighbors and stuff, or you may turn it against the West because you become skilled at blaming them for your own problems.
We'll take three questions, not dissertations, questions.
You mentioned earlier that you could read the Quran but not understand the Islamic faith without the historical context.
Yeah.
How important is it then that we read the Quran to understand Islam?
It's always good to know what it says, especially if you ever do run into Muslims, because in my experience, I used to go to Speaker's Corner in London on Sundays in the summer, and that's a place where Christians and Muslims argue and stuff, and I would take students down there to see what would happen to them. And Muslims will typically say, and the Quran says, and I would go, no, it doesn't. Or they would say the hadith, which are the collections of stories that are more like the Bible in the sense that they have histories in them and biographies and so on. I'd say, well, it's in the hadith. And I'd say, no, it's not there either. Just trust me about this. So the Muslim would have to back off and try something else. So reading a Quran, I would recommend reading it, yeah. But to understand Islam, you cannot understand Islam if you do not understand the role of Muhammad, the continuing role of Muhammad, and the role he plays in shaping the lives of every Muslim and every Muslim culture. That's really the key thing.